It was ignored by the shoppers squabbling over the few remaining bottles of supplements. Jared helped Molly up and returned the purse to the lady. She put the Vitacalf bottles inside.
"I shall pay for these another day," she said.
And as Mary assisted her to her feet,
"Thank you. I shop here all the time, and some of these people are my neighbors, but I don't know any of them tonight."
She limped away, holding her purse tight against her chest.
"I want to go back to Graham's," Molly cried.
"You get the stuff," Mary said to Jared. "Her name is Norma, and she's got a lot of frizzy blonde hair. I'll take Molly back to the car."
"I know. Mrs. Ransom told me," Jared said.
"Be careful."
She moved away, leading Molly by the hand, and then turned back.
"If she's reluctant to sell to you, tell her that Eric Blass sent you. That might help."
She must have seen the hurt in his eyes, because she gave a little wince before half running for the front of the store, bent protectively over the frightened girl. 6. A man was standing halfway down the long produce section, smoking a cigarette. He was dressed in white pants and a white smock top, with "produce manager" on the left breast in red thread. He wore an almost peaceful expression on his face as he watched the pandemonium that had engulfed his store. He saw Jared approach, nodded at him, and spoke as if resuming a conversation they'd been having.
"This shit will quiet down after all the women are asleep. They cause most of the trouble, you know. You're looking at a man who knows. I'm a 3-time loser in the marriage wars. Not just a loser, either. Routed I've been each time. Like matrimony is Vicksburg and I'm the Confederacy."
"I'm looking for
Norma, most likely," the produce manager said.
"Is she here?"
"Nope, left half an hour ago, after she sold the last of her product. Except for the stuff she kept for herself, I suppose. But I've got some fresh blueberries. Add 'em to your cereal, perks it right up."
"Thanks, I'll pass," Jared said.
"There is a bright side," the produce manager said. "My alimony payments will soon cease. The South rises again. We been kilt, but we ain't whooped yet."
"What?"
"Just kilt, not whooped. I'll bring you a piece of Lincoln's tailcoat, Colonel. It's Faulkner. Don't they teach you kids anything in school these days?"
Jared made his way toward the front of the store, avoiding the scrum at the checkout lanes. Several stations were unattended, and shoppers were hurrying through them with loaded baskets. Outside, a man in a checkered shirt sat on the bus bench with a shopping basket on his lap. It was loaded with cans of Maxwell House. He caught Jared's eye.
"My wife is napping," he declared, "but I'm sure she'll wake up soon."
"Hope that works out for you," Jared said, and broke into a run. Mary was in the passenger seat of the Datsun with Molly on her lap. She gave the girl a shake as Jared got in behind the wheel and spoke in a too loud voice.
"Here he is. Here he is. It's our pal Jared."
"Hi, Jared,"
Molly said in a hoarse, teary voice.
"Molly was getting all sleepy,"
Mary said in that same too loud, too jolly voice.
"But she's awake now. Wide awake. We both are, aren't we, Molls? Tell us some more about Olive, why don't you?"
The little girl climbed out of Mary's lap and into the back seat.
"I don't want to."
"Did you get it?"
Mary's voice was low now, low and strained.
"Did you?"
Jared started the car.
"She's gone.
A lot of other people got there first.
You're out of luck.
Mrs. Ransom, too." He left the Shopwell parking lot fast, wheeling effortlessly around the cars that tried to get in his way. He was too upset to worry about his driving, and thus did it better than ever before.
"Are we going to Graham's now? I want to go to Graham's."
"Right after I drop Mary," Jared said. "She needs to call her bestie Eric, see if he's holding." It felt good for a second to strike at her, to unload the fear that was running through him. Only for a second, though. It was childish crap. He hated it, and yet he couldn't seem to help it.
"What do you mean, holding?"
Molly asked, but no one answered her. It was twilight when they got to the pack house. Jared pulled into the driveway and put Mrs. Ransom's Datsun in park. Mary peered at him in the gathering gloom of Aurora's first night.
Jer, I wasn't going with him to see Arcade Fire. I was going to break the date.
He said nothing. Maybe she was telling the truth, maybe she wasn't. All he knew was that she and Eric were chummy enough for Eric to have given her the name of a local dope dealer.
You're being a baby, Mary said.
Jared stared straight ahead.
Okay, then, Mary said. Okay, baby. Baby wants his bottle.
The hell with it. And you.
You two are fighting like my mother and father, Molly said and began to cry again. I wish you'd stop. I wish you'd be boyfriend and girlfriend again.
Mary got out, slammed the door, and started up the driveway. She had almost reached the back stoop when Jared realized that there was an actual possibility that the next time he saw her, she might be buried in a white shroud of unknown origin. He looked at Molly and said, Keep your eyes open. If you fall asleep, I'll knock your block off. Jared climbed out of the car and ran after Mary. He caught her just as she was opening the back door. She turned to him, startled. A cloud of moths circled the overhead light, and her face was dappled with their weaving shadows.
I'm sorry, he said. Mary, I'm really sorry. It's just so crazy. For all I know, my mother's asleep in her car somewhere, and I'm scared, and I couldn't get what you needed, and I'm sorry.
Okay, she said.
Don't go to sleep tonight. Please don't.
He pulled her into his arms and kissed her. Wonder of wonders, she kissed him back, mouth open, her breath mingling with his.
I'm officially awake, she said, pulling back to look into his face. Now take Little Red Blabbing Hood back to her gram.
He started down the steps, rethought that, went back, and kissed her again.
Wowee, Molly said when he returned to the car.
He could hear in her voice that her mood had dramatically improved.
You guys were really sucking face.
We were, weren't we?
Jared said. He felt dazed, a stranger in his own body. He could still feel her lips and taste her breath.
Let's get you home.
The last leg of that long, strange trip was only 9 blocks, and Jared drove it without incident, finally rolling along Tremaine Street past the empty houses. He pulled into Mrs. Ransom's driveway. The headlights swept across the figure seated in a lawn chair, a body without face. Jared slammed on the brakes. Mrs. Ransom sat in the glare, a mummy. Molly began to scream, and Jared doused the headlights. He threw the Datsun into reverse and banged across the street to his own driveway. When he unfastened Molly's seatbelt, Jared drew the kid from the car and into his arms. She clung to him, and that was all right. It felt good.
No worries, he said, stroking her hair.
It was in clumps, matted with sweat.
You're staying with me. We're gonna put on some movies and pull an all-nighter.
Chapter 14 1 Maura Dunbarton, once the subject of newspaper headlines, now largely forgotten, sat on the lower bunk of B-11, the cell she had shared with Kaylee Rawlings for the last 4 years. The cell door was open. On B-Wing, all the cell doors were open, and Maura did not believe they would roll closed and be locked from the booth tonight. No, not tonight. The tiny TV set in the wall was on and tuned to News America, but Maura had muted the sound. She knew what was going on. By now, even the dimmest inmate in dueling knew. Rioting at home and abroad, read the super running across the bottom of the screen. This was followed by a list of cities. Most were American, because you cared about your own before you cared about those in more distant places. But Maura had also seen Calcutta, Sydney, Moscow, Cape Town, Mexico City, Bombay, and London before she stopped looking. It was funny when he thought about it. What were all those men rioting about? What did they think they could accomplish? Maura wondered if there would have been riots if it had been the other half of the human race who were falling asleep. She thought it unlikely. Kaylee's head, swaddled in a white helmet that pulsed in and out with her breathing,
lay in Mora's lap. Mora held one of Kaylee's white-gloved hands, but she didn't attempt to tamper with the material. There had been an announcement over the prison intercom system that it could be dangerous to do so, and the same warning had been thoroughly conveyed on the news broadcasts. Though the filament was slightly sticky and very dense, Mora could still feel Kaylee's fingers buried inside, like pencils encased in thick plastic. She and Kaylee had been lovers almost from the time Kaylee, years younger, took up residence in B-11, doing time for assault with a deadly weapon. Age difference aside, they matched. Kaylee's slightly cockeyed sense of humor fit Mora's cynicism. Kay was good-natured, filling the dark pits that had been eaten into Mora's character by the things she had seen and the things she had done. She was a slick dancer, she was a wonderful kisser, and although they didn't make love often these days, when they did, it was still good. As they lay together with their legs entwined, there was no prison for a little while, and no confusing outside world, either. It was just them. Kaylee was also a fine singer. She had won the prison talent show 3 years running. Last October, there hadn't been a dry eye in the house when she finished singing a cappella, "The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face." Mora supposed all that was over now. People talked in their sleep. Few, if any, sang in their sleep. Even if Kaylee should be moved to sing, it would come out all muffled. And what if that crap was all down her throat as well? And in her lungs? It probably was, although if that were the case, how she could go on breathing was a mystery. Mora raised one knee, then the other, back and forth, up and down, rocking her lover gently. "Why did you have to go to sleep, honey? Why couldn't you wait?" Jeanette and Angel came by then, pushing a cart with two large coffee urns and two large plastic pitchers of juice on it. Mora could smell their approach before she saw them because, man, that brew smelled bitter. Officer Rand Quigley was shepherding them along. Mora wondered how many of the female guards were left. She guessed not many, and few would show up for the next shift. Maybe none.
"Coffee, Mora?" Angel asked. "It'll pep you right the fuck up."
"No," Mora said. Up and down went her knees, up and down. Rock-a-bye Kaylee in the treetop.
"Sure, it'll keep you going. If I'm lying, I'm dying."
"No," Mora repeated. "Get on." Quigley didn't like Mora's tone. "Watch your mouth, inmate." "Or what? You'll tonk me on the head with your stick and put me to sleep? Go ahead. That might be the only way I manage it." Quigley didn't reply. He looked frazzled. Mora didn't see why he should be. None of this would touch him. No man would bear this cross.
"You get that insomnia, don't you?"
Angel asked. "Yeah, takes one to know one."
"Lucky us,"
Angel said. Wrong, Mora thought. Unlucky us. "Is that Kaylee?" Jeanette asked. "No," Mora said. "It's Whoopi fucking Goldberg under that mess." "I'm sorry," Jeanette said. And she looked sorry, and that hurt Mora's heart in a way she had been guarding against. She would not cry in front of Officer Quigley or these young ones, though. She would not. "Get on," I said. When they were gone with their fucked-up coffee wagon, Mora bent over her sleeping celly, if you could call it sleep. To Mora, it looked more like a magic spell from a fairy tale. Love had come late for her, and it was a miracle that it had come at all, she knew that. Like a rose blooming in a bomb crater. She should be grateful for the time the two of them had had, all the greeting cards and pop songs said so. But when she looked at the grotesque membrane covering Kaylee's sweet face, she found that her well of gratitude, always shallow, was now dry. Not her eyes, though. With the coffee crew and Officer Quigley gone, nothing left but the trailing stink of that strange brew, she let the tears come. They fell on the white stuff enclosing Kaylee's head, and the white stuff sucked the moisture up greedily. "If she's somewhere close, and if I could just go to sleep, maybe I could catch up. Then we could go together." But no, because of the insomnia. She had lived with it since the night she had methodically slaughtered her entire family, finishing with Slugger, their elderly German shepherd. Petting him, soothing him, letting him lick her hand, then cutting his throat. If she got 2 hours of unconsciousness at night, she considered herself lucky. On many nights, she got none at all, and nights in dueling could be long. But dueling was just a place. Insomnia had been her real prison across these years. Insomnia was boundless, and it never put her on good report. "I'll be awake after most of them are asleep," she thought. "Guards and inmates both. I'll have the run of the place. Always assuming I want to stay, that is. And why would I want to go anywhere else? She might wake up, my Kaylee. With a thing like this, anything is possible. Isn't it?" Maura couldn't sing the way Kaylee could. Hell, couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. But there was a song Kaylee especially liked, and now Maura sang it to her as she gently raised her knees up and down, as if operating the pedals of an invisible organ. Maura's husband had listened to it all the time, and Maura had learned the words by osmosis. Kay heard her singing it to herself once and demanded Maura teach her.
"Ah, that's naughty," Kaylee had exclaimed.
It had been on an LP by a bunch of goofy potato eaters. That was how long Maura had been inside. Her husband had owned an extensive collection of LPs. He didn't matter now. Mr. Dunbarton had been put into an everlasting slumber early on the morning of January 7th, 1984. She'd given him the knife first, right in the chest, plunged it like a shovel into loam, and he sat straight up and his eyes had said, "Why?" Because that was why. And she'd have killed him or anyone else over and over and over again, would do it this very moment if it would bring Kaylee back to her. "Listen, Kay. Listen. In the female prison there are 70 women, and I wish it was with them that I did dwell." On the little TV, downtown Las Vegas appeared to be burning up. "Then that old triangle could go jingle jangle." She bent and kissed the white cocoon that had buried Kaylee's face. The taste was sour on her lips, but she didn't mind, because Kaylee was beneath. Her Kay. All along the banks of the Royal Canal. Maura leaned back, closed her eyes, and prayed for sleep. It did not come. 2. Richland Lane curved gently to the left before dead-ending at a small park. The first thing Lila saw when she came around this curve was a couple of garbage cans lying overturned in the street. The second was a knot of yelling neighbors in front of the Elway house. A teenage girl in a tracksuit sprinted toward the cruiser. In the light of the flashing jackpots, her face was a stuttering picture of dismay. Lila hammered on the brake and opened the door, unsnapping the strap over the butt of her pistol.
"Come quick! She's killing him!"
Lila ran for the house, kicking one of the garbage cans aside and pushing past a couple of men. One of them held up a bleeding hand.
"I tried to stop her, and the bitch bit me. She was like a rabid dog."
Lila stopped at the end of the driveway, her gun hanging down beside her right thigh, trying to process what she was seeing. A woman in a frog squat on the asphalt. She appeared to be swathed in a muslin nightgown, at once form-fitting and ragged, leaking countless loose threads. Decorative bricks, patriotically painted in red, white, and blue, lined the drive on both sides. The woman held one in her left hand and one in her right. She was chopping them down, edge first, on the body of a man wearing a blood-drenched, dueling sheriff's department uniform. Lila thought it must be Roger, although it would take fingerprints or a DNA test to be sure. Except for a remnant of broad chin, his face was gone, cratered like a stomped ground apple. Blood ran down the driveway in creeks, flashing blue each time her cruiser's jackpot lights strobed. The woman crouched over Roger was snarling. Her flushed face, Jessica Elway's face, was visible, only partially screened by the tatters of the webs that her husband must have made the lethal mistake of removing. The hands on the plunging bricks were gloved in red. That's not Jessica Elway, Lila thought. It can't be, can it?
Stop! Stop it right now!
For a wonder, the woman did. She looked up, her bloodshot eyes so wide they seemed to fill half her face. She stood, holding a dripping brick in each hand, one red, one blue. God bless America. Lila saw a couple of Roger's teeth stuck in the cocoon material hanging down from her chin.
Watch out, Sheriff, one of the men said. She sure does look rabid to me.
Drop them!
She raised her Glock. Lila had never been so tired, but her arm was steady.
Drop the bricks!
Jessica dropped one and appeared to consider. Then she raised the other brick and ran, not at Lila, but at one of the men who had crept closer for a better look, and hard as it was for Lila to believe, to take a picture. The man's cell phone was raised at Jessica. As she approached, he squealed and turned tail, head down and shoulders hunched. He knocked the girl in the tracksuit, sprawling.
Drop it, drop it, drop it!
The Jessica thing paid no attention. She leaped over the girl in the tracksuit and raised the remaining brick. There was no one behind her. All the neighbors had scattered. Lila fired twice, and Jessica Elway's head exploded. Chunks of scalp with yellow hair still attached flew backward.
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
It was the fallen girl. Lila helped the girl to her feet. Go home, hon. And when the girl started to look toward Jessica Elway, Lila turned her head away. She raised her voice.
All of you, go home. In your houses, now.
The man with the cell phone was creeping back, looking for a good angle, one where he could capture every bit of the carnage. He wasn't a man, though. Beneath his sandy hair, his features were soft and teenage. She recognized him from the local newspaper, some high school kid. She didn't know his name, some kind of sports star, probably. Lila pointed a shaking finger at him. You take a picture with that thing and I'll stuff it down your motherfucking throat. The kid, it was Eric Blass's friend, Kurt McLeod, stared at her, brows furrowing together.
It's a free country, isn't it?
Not tonight, Lila said. Then she screamed, shocking herself as much as the cluster of neighbors.
Get out! Get out! Go!
Kurt and the others went, a few snatching glances back over their shoulders, as if afraid she might come flying after them, as crazy as the woman she'd just shot down in the street.
I knew they had no business putting in a lady sheriff, one man called over his shoulder.
Lila restrained the urge to give him the finger and walked back to her cruiser. When a lock of hair fell in her eyes, she brushed it back with a panicky shudder, thinking it was that stuff trying to spin out of her skin again. She leaned against the door, took a couple of deep breaths, keyed her mic. Lenny?
I'm here, boss.
Is everyone coming in? A pause. Then Lenny said,
Well, I got five. Both Whitstocks, Elmore, Vern, and Dan Treat. And Reed's coming back soon, too. His wife fell asleep. I guess his neighbor is going to look after a little Gary, the poor kid.
Lila did the addition, and it came to eight officers. Not much when you were hoping to fend off anarchy. None of Dueling's three female deputies had responded to Lenny's calls. It made Lila wonder how they were doing at the prison. She closed her eyes, started to drift, and forced them open again. Lenny was onto the subject of the countless emergency calls. There had been more than a dozen from men like Reed Barrows who suddenly found themselves the sole guardians of small male children.
Several of these feckless fools wanted me to explain to them how to feed their own children. This one idiot asked me if FEMA is setting up a facility to take care of kids because he's got tickets for a...
Any of them at the station yet?
Who, FEMA?
No, Lenny. Any of the deputies. Not Terry, though. Please not him. Lila didn't want Terry to see what was left of the man he'd most often partnered with for the last 5 years.
Afraid not. The only person here is that old guy from Adopt-a-Highway and the VFD. Wanted to know if he could do anything. He's outside smoking his pipe.
It took a few seconds for her exhausted, shocked brain to process this. Willie Burke, who knew about fairy handkerchiefs and who drove a rattletrap Ford pickup.
I want him. That guy? Really?
Yes. I'm at 65 Richland Lane.
Isn't that...
Yes. It's bad, Lenny. Very. Jessica killed Roger. He must have cut open the stuff on her face. She chased him outside, and she came at a kid with a brick, some little asshole. He was trying to take her fucking picture. She was out of her mind. What mind? Lila thought. I warned her to stop, and when she didn't, I shot her. She's dead. There was no choice.
Roger's dead?
Nothing about his wife being dead. Lila wasn't surprised. Lenny had always had a soft spot for Roger. Send Willie out here. Tell him we'll be transporting two bodies to the hospital morgue. He should bring a tarp. Hold the deputies there at the station. I'll come as soon as I can. Out. She lowered her head and prepared to cry. No tears came. She wondered if a person could be too tired to cry. It seemed possible. Today, anything seemed possible. Her cell phone rang in its little holster on her utility belt. It was Clint. Hello, Clint, she answered. This isn't really the best time to talk. Are you all right? He asked. You don't sound all right. Lila wasn't sure where to begin. With Roger and Jessica Elway dead in the yard? With the hallucination she'd had out by the power lines in the woods behind the rubble of Truman Mayweather's meth shack? With Sheila Norcross? With Shannon Parks? With the day Clint shut down his practice with no advance warning? With their marriage vows? You're not falling asleep, are you? Lila?
No, I'm right here.
Janice is out of commission. Long story. Hicks has gone off. Somehow I've ended up in charge of this place. Lila said she was sorry. It was a difficult situation, no question about it. But maybe it would look better once he had some sleep. Her husband could do that, go to sleep, and then wake up again. He said he was going home to check on their son. Jared had said he'd hurt his knee and it was nothing serious, but Clint wanted to see it for himself. Did Lila want to meet him there?
I'll try.
But Lila didn't know when she'd be able to get away. All she knew was that it looked like it was going to be another late one.
3. Do you hear that?
A woman had found Kaylee Rawlings in the dark. The woman smelled like booze and had a soft arm. Magda, she said her name was.
Singing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was Mora singing. Mora's voice wasn't worth a shit. Her sense of a tune was all seasick, up and down, and creaky and broken. And to Kaylee, right then, it was incomparably sweet, carrying off the silly old words of that dirty old air.
Royal Canal.
The singing stopped.
Where was it coming from?
I don't know.
Somewhere far away, that was about the only thing Kaylee could tell for sure. Had it drifted all the way from Dueling? Where was Dueling? This was definitely not Dueling. Or was it? Hard to tell. Impossible, really. A gentle wind circled through the darkness. The air was fresh and good, and under her feet, the ground felt not like cement or sticky tile, but like grass. She squatted down and touched. Yes, it was grass, or weeds, about knee-high. Birds chattered faintly somewhere. Kaylee had awakened, feeling strong and young and well-rested. Correctional had taken 12 years from her, the better part of her 30s, the first couple of years of her 40s, and it had a claim on another 10. Mora was the best part of those lost years. It wasn't something that could ever have worked outside the walls, of course, the deal they had, but in prison you made do. If Kaylee had been suddenly shoved out the doors of Dueling Correctional, she would have remembered Mora fondly and gratefully and moved on. You didn't carry a torch for a triple murderer, no matter how strangely charming you found them. The woman was nuts. Kaylee had no illusions about that. She loved Kaylee wholly, though, and Kaylee loved to be loved. And, you know, maybe she, Kaylee, was a little nuts, too. There had been no heedless love in the time before prison. No love of any kind, really, not since she was a little child. On one job, not the one they clipped her for, Kaylee and her boyfriend had knocked over a pill shop in back of an hourly motel. In the room, there'd been a teenage kid in a rocking chair. The rocking chair had been nice, polished to a glow, totally out of place in the Fleabag motel, a throne amid garbage. The kid who sat in it had a massive, volcanic hole in his cheek. It was a glossy, swirling mix of red and pitch black, a hot mess from which came the wafting smell of rotting flesh. How had it happened? Had it started with a scratch, a scrape, a tiny infection? Or had someone cut him with a dirty blade? Was it a disease? Kaylee felt lucky not to have to know or care. She put the kid at about 16. He scratched his pale belly and watched as she and her boyfriend kicked around, searching for the stash. What else was wrong with him that he just sat there, calm as could be, and watched them with no fear? Kaylee's boyfriend found what he was hunting for under the mattress and stuffed it into his jacket. He turned to the kid. "Your face is putrid," he said. "You know that?"
"I know," the kid said.
"Good. Now get the fuck out of the chair, son." The kid didn't give any trouble. He got up from the chair and dropped onto the sprung bed, lying there and scratching his stomach. They took the rocking chair along with the money and the drugs. They could do that because the boyfriend had a panel truck. That was the kind of life she led in those days, one where she had stood by and helped the man she slept with steal the very chair a kid was sitting in. A ruined kid. And guess what? It was a life where the kid did nothing about it. He just lay down and pointed his ruined face at the ceiling and scratched his belly and did fuck all else. Maybe because he was stoned. Maybe because he didn't give a shit. Maybe both. There was a floral scent on the breeze. Kaylee felt a pang for Mora, but at the same time she was stirred by an intuition that this was a better place. Better than prison. Better than the world outside prison. It felt boundless, and there was earth beneath her feet.
"Whoever you are, I got to tell you I'm scared," said Magda, "and I'm worried about Anton."
"Don't be scared," said Kaylee. "I'm sure Anton's fine."
Not knowing who that was, nor caring. She felt for Magda's hand and found it.
"Let's walk toward the birdsong."
They edged forward in the blackness, finding themselves moving down a gentle grade among trees. And was that a glimmer of a light there? Was that a crack of sun in the sky? It was blazing dawn when they came to the overgrown remains of a trailer. From there, they were able to follow the ghost of a dirt lane to the time-shattered pavement of Balls Hill Road. Chapter 15. 1. Leaving old Essie's den behind, the fox cut a zigzag path through the surrounding woods, pausing to rest in the damp below an overgrown shed. In his sleep, he dreamed that his mother brought him a rat, but it was rotten and poison, and he realized that his mother was sick. Her eyes were red, and her mouth hung crooked, and her tongue lolled to the ground. That was when he remembered that she was gone. His mother was many seasons gone. He had seen her lie down in tall grass, and the next day she still lay in the same place, but was no longer his mother.
"There's poison in the walls," said the dead rat in his dead mother's mouth. "She says the earth is made of our bodies. I believe her, and oh, the pain doesn't end. Even death hurts."
A cloud of moths descended on the fox's dead mother and the dead rat.
"Don't stop, child," said the mother fox. "You have work."
The fox jerked up out of his sleep and felt a sharp pain as he struck his shoulder against the edge of something jutting down, a nail or glass or a shard of board. It was early evening. From close by came a thunderous crash, metal and wood,
a gasp of steam, the tearing sound of fire catching. The fox darted from under the overgrown shed, breaking hard for the road. Beyond the road loomed the bigger woods, and he hoped safer ground. At the side of the road, a car was buckled against a tree. A woman on fire was dragging a man from the front seat of the car. The man was screaming. The sound the burning woman made was a dog sound. The fox understood what it meant. I will kill you. I will kill you. I will kill you. Tendrils of burning web fluttered away from her body. Here was a moment of decision. High among the fox's catalog of personal statutes was "Thou shalt not cross the road in daylight." There were more cars in the day, and cars could not be intimidated or warned off, let alone defeated. As they zoomed over the pavement, they made a sound, too, and if you listened, a fox should always listen, that sound was words, and the words were, "I want to kill you. I want to kill you. I want to kill you." The hot and leaking remains of animals that had failed to heed these words had provided the fox with many excellent snacks. On the other hand, a fox that wanted to survive needed to maintain a fluid approach to danger. He needed to balance the threat of a car that wanted to kill you with a woman cloaked in fire declaring that she was going to kill you. The fox bolted. As he passed her, the heat of the burning woman was in his fur and in the cut on his back. The burning woman had started to pound the man's head against the pavement, and the roar of her anger grew louder, but it faded as the fox scrambled down the embankment on the opposite side of the road. In the big woods, he slowed his pace. The cut in his lower back made his rear right leg hurt every time he pushed off. It was night. Last year's leaves crackled under the fox's paths. He stopped to drink from a stream. Oil swirled in the water, but he was thirsty and had to take what he could get. A hawk perched on a stump by the stream. It picked at the belly of a squirrel. "Let me have some," the fox called. "I could be a friend to you." "A fox has no friends," said the hawk. It was true, but the fox would never admit it. "What liar told you that?" "You're bleeding, you know," the hawk said. The fox didn't care for the bird's chipper tone. The fox thought it wise to change the subject. "What's going on? Something has changed. What's happened to the world?" "There's a tree further on. A new tree. A mother tree. It appeared at dawn. Very beautiful. Very tall. I tried to fly to the top, but although I could see the crown, it was beyond my wings." A bright red knot of intestine snapped free of the squirrel's body, and the hawk gulped it down. The hawk tilted its head. A second later, a smell twitched the fox's nostrils. Smoke. It had been a dry season. If the burning woman had crossed the road, a few steps into the brush would have been enough to make it all go up. The fox needed to get moving again. He panted. He was afraid and he was hurt, but he still had his wits. "Your eyes will make a fine meal for some lucky animal," the hawk said, and took flight, the limp squirrel locked in its talons. 2. As was hardly uncommon, the first Thursday book club had begun to drift away from that month's text, which happened to be Atonement by Ian McEwan. The novel's story followed two lovers, sundered from one another almost before their relationship had begun, by the false accusation of a preternaturally imaginative young girl named Bryony. Dorothy Harper, at 79, the group's elder stateswoman, said she was unable to forgive Bryony for her crime. That little baggage ruined their lives. Who cares if she was sorry? "They say the brain doesn't fully develop until you're much older," said Gail Collins. "Bryony was only 12 or 13 when she told a lie. You can't blame her." Gail held her glass of white wine in both hands, cupped around the bowl. She was situated at the nook table by the kitchen bar. Blanche McIntyre, Warden Coates's faithful assistant, usually faithful at least, had met Gail in a secretarial class 30 years earlier. Margaret O'Donnell, the fourth member of the First Thursday Book Club, was Gail's sister, and the only woman Blanche knew who had a stock portfolio.
Who says that? Dorothy asked. About the brain.
Scientists, Gale said. Pish tush.
Dorothy waved a hand as if to make a bad smell go away. Dorothy was the only woman Blanche knew who still said things like pish tush.
It's true.
Blanche had heard Dr. Norcross at the prison say almost exactly the same thing, that the human brain wasn't fully developed until a person reached their 20s. Was it really such a surprise, though? If you had ever known a teenager, or for that matter, been one, wasn't it axiomatic? Teenagers didn't know what the hell they were doing, especially male ones. And a girl of 12? Forget it. Dorothy sat in the armchair by the front window. It was her condo, a neat second-floor unit on Molloy Street, with plush, slate-colored carpeting and fresh beige walls. The view was of the woods that backed up the building. Of the world's current unrest, the only visible sign was a fire, like a match flame at this distance, off in the west, toward Balls Hill and Route 17. It was just so cruel. I don't care how small her brain was. Blanche and Margaret were seated on the couch. On the coffee table stood the open bottle of Chablis and the still-corked bottle of Pinot. There was also the plate of cookies that Dorothy had baked and the three bottles of pills that Margaret had brought.
I loved it, said Margaret. I loved the whole book. I thought all the details about nursing during the Blitz were amazing. And everything about the big battle and France and walking to the shore. Wow, a real trek. An epic trek, you could say. And romance, too. It was pretty spicy stuff.
She shook her head and laughed. Blanche twisted to look at her, annoyed, despite the fact that Margaret was on her side about liking atonement. Margaret had worked for the railroads until they gave her a nifty bundle of cash to take early retirement. Some people were just so darn lucky. She was a terrible giggler, was Margaret O'Donnell, especially for someone who is past 70. And foolish about ceramic animals, dozens of which were crowded on her windowsills. For her last book pick, she'd chosen the Hemingway novel about the idiot who wouldn't let go of the fish, a book that had aggravated Blanche because it was, let's face it, just a goddamn fish. Margaret had thought that one was romantic, too. How could a woman like that have turned her early retirement bundle into a stock portfolio? It was a mystery. Now Blanche said,
Come on, Midge. We're grown women. Let's not get silly about sex. Oh, it's not that. It's such a grand book. We're just so lucky to go out on this one.
Margaret rubbed her forehead. She peered at Blanche over the tops of her horn-rimmed glasses.
Wouldn't it have been awful to die on a bad book?
I suppose, Blanche replied.
But who says that this thing that's happening is death? Who says we're going to die?
The meeting had been scheduled for that night, long before Aurora hit. They never missed a first Thursday. And the four old friends had spent much of the day texting like teenagers, back and forth, about whether, given the circumstances, they ought to cancel. No one had wanted to, though. First Thursday was first Thursday. Dorothy had texted that if it was her last night, getting dizzy with her friends sounded like the way to do it. Gale and Margaret had voted the same. And Blanche had, too, feeling a little guilty about leaving Warden Coates in the lurch, but that she was well within her rights, having already gone way into overtime for which the state would not compensate her. Besides, Blanche wanted to talk about the book. Like Dorothy, she was amazed at the evil of the little girl Bryony, and also of the way that the evil child had matured into quite a different sort of adult. Then, once they had settled in Dorothy's living room, Margaret had produced the bottles of lorazepam. The bottles were a couple of years old. When her husband passed away, the doctor gave it to her, just to help you cope, Midge. Margaret never took any. Though she was sad to lose her husband, her nerves were fine, maybe better, actually, since once he was dead, she no longer had to worry about him killing himself, shoveling the driveway in the winters, or climbing up on the ladder to cut tree branches that were awfully close to the power lines. But because her insurance covered the cost, she had filled the prescriptions anyway. You never knew what might come in handy, was her motto. Or when. Now it seemed that when had arrived.
Better to do it together, was what I was thinking,
Margaret said.
Less scary that way.
The other three had, with no significant objections, agreed that it was a good idea. Dorothy Harper was also a widow. Gail's husband was in a nursing home and did not recognize even his children these days. And speaking of the children of the First Thursday gals, they were middle-aged adults who lived in places far from the hills of Appalachia, and no last-minute reunion was feasible. Blanche, the only non-retiree among the group, had never married or had children at all, which was probably for the best, considering how things were turning out. Now, the question Blanche had asked put the laughter to a stop.
"Maybe we'll wake up as butterflies," Gail said. "The cocoons I've seen on the news, they remind me a little of the cocoons that caterpillars make."
"Spiders wrap up flies, too. I think the cocoons look more like that than like any sort of chrysalis,"
Margaret said.
"I'm not counting on anything."
Blanche's full glass had at some point in the last few minutes become an empty glass.
"I hope to see an angel," Dorothy said.
The other three looked to her. She did not seem to be joking. Her wrinkled chin and mouth tightened into a tiny fist.
"I've been pretty good, you know," she added. "Tried to be kind. Good wife, good mother, good friend. Volunteered in retirement. Why, I drove all the way to Coughlin just on Monday for my committee meeting."
"We know,"
said Margaret, and extended a hand in the air toward Dorothy, who was the very definition of a good old soul. Gail echoed this, and so did Blanche. They passed around the pill bottles, and each woman took 2 tablets and swallowed them. Following this act of communion, the 4 friends sat and looked at each other.
"What should we do now?"
Gail asked.
"Just wait?"
"Cry,"
Margaret said, and giggled as she pretended to rub at her eyes with her knuckles.
"Cry, cry, cry."
"Pass the cookies around," Dorothy said. "I'm quitting my diet."
"I want to get back to the book," Blanche said. "I want to talk about how Bryony changed. She was like a butterfly. I thought that was lovely. It reminded me of some of the women in the prison."
Gail had retrieved the Pinot from the coffee table. She unwrapped the foil and stuck in the corkscrew. While she went around pouring everyone a new glass, Blanche continued,
"You know, there's a lot of recidivism. Fallback, I mean. Breaking parole and getting back into bad habits and such. But some of them do change. Some of them start brand new lives. Like Bryony. Isn't that inspiring?"
"Yes," Gail said. She raised her glass. "To emerging new lives."
3. Frank and Elaine lingered in the doorway of Nana's room. It was past 9. They'd laid her down on the bed, leaving aside the covers. There was a poster of a uniformed marching band on the wall and a bulletin board tacked with Nana's best drawings of manga characters. A wind chime of colored pipes and glass beads hung from the ceiling. Elaine insisted on neatness, so there were no clothes or toys on the floor. The blinds were pulled shut. Around Nana's head, the growth was bulbous. The growths bunched around her hands were identical, only smaller. Mittens with no thumbs. Though neither had said anything, after standing together in silence for more than a minute, Frank realized that they were both afraid to turn off the light.
"Let's come back and check on her again in a little while."
Out of habit, Frank whispered this to Elaine, as on so many occasions when they were desperate to keep from waking Nana, instead of the opposite. Elaine nodded. As one, they retreated from their daughter's open door and went downstairs to the kitchen. While Elaine sat at the table, Frank made a pot of coffee, filling the urn, sifting out the grounds. It was something he'd done 1,000 times before, though never at so late an hour. The normality of the activity soothed him. She was thinking along similar lines. "It's like the old days, isn't it? Sick baby upstairs, us down here wondering if we're doing the right things." Frank pressed the brew button. Elaine had her head on the table, tucked between her arms.
"You should sit up," he said gently, and took the chair across from her.
She nodded and sat up straight. Her bangs were stuck to her forehead, and she had the querulous, "What's that who now?" look of someone who had recently absorbed a blow to the skull. He didn't suppose he looked any better. "Anyway, I know what you mean," said Frank. "I remember. Questioning how we ever could have tricked ourselves into thinking we could take care of another human being in the first place." This brought a bright smile to Elaine's face. Whatever was happening to them now, they'd survived an infant together. No small achievement. The coffee machine beeped. For a moment, it had seemed quiet, but Frank suddenly became aware of the noise outside. Someone was yelling. There were police sirens, a car alarm whooping. He instinctively tilted his ear toward the stairs, toward Nana. He didn't hear anything. Of course he didn't. She wasn't a baby anymore, and these weren't the old days, weren't like any days ever before. The way Nana was sleeping tonight, it was impossible to imagine what kind of racket would rouse her, cause her to open her eyes beneath that layer of white fiber. Elaine had her head canted the same way toward the stairs.
"What is this, Frank?"
"I don't know." He broke away from her gaze. "We shouldn't have left the hospital." Implying that Elaine had made them go, not sure he really believed it, but needing to share the blame, to kick a little of the dirt he felt on himself back onto her. That he knew he was doing this, knew it exactly, made him hate himself. He couldn't stop, though. "We should have stayed. Nana needs a doctor."
"They all do, Frank. Soon I'll need a doctor, too."
She poured herself a cup of the coffee. Years passed while she stirred in milk and equal. He thought that part of the discussion was over, but then she said,
"You should be grateful that I made us leave."
"What?"
"It saved you from doing whatever you might have done if we hadn't."
"What are you talking about?" But he knew, of course. Each marriage had its own language, its own code words built of mutual experience. She said two of them now.
"Fritz Mischaum."
At each rotation of her spoon, it clicked against the ceramic of the mug. Click, click, click. Like the combination dial on a safe. 4. Fritz Mischaum. A name of ill repute, one Frank wished he could forget, but would Elaine let him? No. Shouting at Nana's teacher that time had been bad, and the famous wall punch had been worse, but the Fritz Mischaum incident was worst of all. Fritz Mischaum was the dead rat she waved in his face whenever she felt pushed into a corner, as she did tonight. If only she could see they were in the corner together, on the same side, Nana's side. But no. Instead, she had to bring up Fritz Mischaum. She had to wave the dead rat. Frank had been hunting a fox, not that unusual in the wooded Tri-County area. Someone had seen one running around in the field south of Route 17, not far from the women's prison. It had its tongue hanging out, and the caller thought it might be rabid. Frank had his doubts, but he took rabies calls seriously. Any animal control officer worth his salt did. He drove out to the collapsing barn where the sighting had occurred and spent a half hour stalking around in the puckies. He didn't find anything except the rusted-out skeleton of a 1982 Cutlass with a pair of rotting panties knotted to the antenna. On the way back to the shoulder where he'd parked his truck, he cut alongside a fenced property. The fence was a mix of junk, decaying planks, hubcaps, and corrugated sheet metal so full of holes it did more to invite attention than to discourage intruders. Through the gaps, Frank took in the peeling white house and shabby yard beyond. A tire swing on a fraying rope hung from an oak tree. Black, tattered clothes surrounded by circling insects were piled at the base of the tree. A milk crate full of iron scraps stood guard by the porch steps. A presumably empty oil can was carelessly pitched aside to rest like a hat on top of an unruly growth of bougainvillea, which was itself partially draped over the porch. Glass fragments from a smashed second-floor window were scattered over the bare tar paper roof, and a brand-new Toyota pickup, blue as the Pacific, stood waxed up and parked in the driveway. Littered around its rear tires were a dozen or so spent shotgun shells. Once bright red, now faded to pallid pink, as if they had been there a long time. It was so perfectly country, the wreck of a house and the shiny truck, that Frank almost laughed out loud. He strolled on, smiling to himself, his mind requiring several seconds to compute something that hadn't made sense. The black clothes had been moving, shifting around. Frank retraced his steps to a break in the hodgepodge fence. He watched the clothes. They breathed. And it happened the way it always seemed to, as if in a dream. He didn't slip under the fence and actually walk across the yard so much as he seemed to teleport the distance separating him from the black shape under the tree. It was a dog, although Frank wouldn't have wanted to guess which breed, something medium-sized, maybe a shepherd, maybe a young lab, maybe just a country mongrel. The black fur was tattered and flea-bitten. Where the fur was gone, there were infected patches of exposed skin. The animal's only visible eye was a small white pool sunk into a vaguely head-like shape. Twisted around the dog were four limbs, all of them askew, all clearly broken. Grotesquely, since how could it possibly have run away, a chain was looped around its neck and fastened to the tree. The dog's side lifted and fell with one breath after another.
"You are trespassing," announced a voice behind Frank. "Boy, I got a gun on you."
Frank put up his hands and turned around to behold Fritz Meeschaum. A little man, gnome-like with his stringy red hillbilly beard, he wore jeans and a faded T-shirt.
"Frank?"
Fritz sounded perplexed. They knew each other, though not well, from the squeaky wheel. Frank remembered that Fritz was a mechanic and that some people said you could buy a gun from him if you wanted one. Whether that was true or not, Frank couldn't have said, but they had swapped rounds a few months earlier, seated at the bar and watching a college football game together. Fritz, this dog-torturing monster, had expressed his fondness for the option play. He didn't think the Mountaineers had the talent to air it out with any sustained success. Frank was happy to go along with that. He didn't know much about the sport. Toward the end of the game, though, once Meeschaum was full of beer, he had quit harping on the merits of the option and attempted to engage Frank on the subject of Jews and the federal government.
"Them hooky noses got the whole thing in their pocket, you know that?"
Fritz had leaned forward.
"I mean, my people come from Germany, so I know."
That had been Frank's cue to excuse himself. Now Fritz lowered the rifle he had been aiming.
"What are you doing here? Come to buy a gun? I could sell you a good one. Long or short. Hey, you want a beer?"
Although Frank didn't say anything, some kind of message must have been transmitted by his body language, because Fritz added in a tone of chagrin,
"That dog worry you? Don't let it. Some bitch bit my nephew."
"Your what?"
Nephew.
Fritz shook his head.
"Some of the old words they stick. You'd be surprised how..."
And that was the last thing Meeschaum got out. When Frank finished, the rifle butt he had taken from the bastard and used to do most of the work had been cracked and spattered with blood. The other man sprawled in the dirt, holding his crotch where Frank had repeatedly hammered the rifle butt. His eyes were buried under swelling, and he was spitting up blood with each shaky breath that he dragged out from under the ribs that Frank had sprained or broken for him. The possibility that Fritz would die from the beating had seemed, in the immediate aftermath, not unlikely. Maybe he had not hurt Fritz Meeschaum as badly as he thought, though. That was what he had told himself, even as for weeks he kept an eye on the obituary section and no one came to arrest him. But Frank was without guilt. It had been a little dog, and little dogs couldn't fight back. There wasn't any excuse for it, for torturing an animal like that, no matter how ill-tempered it might be. Some dogs were capable of killing a person. However, no dog would do to a person what Fritz Meeschaum had done to that pitiful creature chained to the base of the tree. What could a dog understand of the pleasure men could take from cruelty? Nothing, and it could never learn. Frank understood, though, and he felt calm in his soul about what he had done to Fritz Meeschaum. As for Meeschaum's wife, how was Frank supposed to know the man even had a wife? Although he did now. Oh, yes. Elaine made sure of that. 5.
His wife? Frank asked. Is that where you're going with this? It didn't surprise me she turned up at the shelter. Fritz Meesham's a son of a bitch. When there had first been talk around town, Elaine had asked if it was